Hi everybody, thanks for joining us. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Peter Llewellyn. I run the services at medcomsnetworking.com. So information services, resources, activities, and so on for people who work in and around medical communications, medical education, medical publishing, and the associated businesses across the world. You'll find lots of information about all sorts of matters to do with medcoms and related businesses. Importantly, there's a number of websites around that. Network Pharma TV is worth giving a shout out to. We've got hundreds of videos there now, many based on webinars like this, but there's other sorts of video content as well. So Network Pharma TV for hundreds of videos. And also a shout out, anybody who's interested in the business, maybe you want to join as a medical writer or an account manager and so on. You'll find lots of information specifically for you at firstmedcomsjob.com. So do go and have a look around. Today, absolutely delighted we've got our panel of publishers again. So this is an annual session we run now. It's great to have you all back. Thank you very much. We're not going to do any slides today. We're just having an open, free-flowing panel discussion. I'm going to ask each of them to introduce themselves, say a few words about what's happening at their company, and then we will go for a discussion, hopefully informed by the audience we have today with their questions and comments. So without further ado, we're going to go in alphabetical order by surname. Let's get the rules straight to begin with. So Claire, you're on first. Tell us who you are and tell us a bit about your company.
Thanks, Peter. I'm Claire Cook. I'm the senior editor at the ADIS Journal, so part of Spring and Nature. Been with the company 15 years in various roles or within journal publishing. And my role is mostly to kind of oversee the ADIS Rapid Plus journals, manage the team of editors and editorial staff, overseeing kind of processes, strategy, business development, any kind of wider projects like journal launches or new article launches, and those kind of things. So what's been happening at ADIS this year? We launched our summary of research articles at the start of the year, which we now have established guidelines for. So this is our standalone summary of a previously published paper written in kind of clear and understandable language. So they're aimed at healthcare professionals, so generally kind of non-specialists in the field and time-poor clinicians, but open access, so available to anyone who would find it useful to have that kind of plain language summary. So the aim is to facilitate accessibility, but without oversimplifying the content. They can be written in-house as well by the ADIS medical writers at the discretion of the ADIS editors. Podcast articles, they continue to be increasingly popular. So these are our standalone articles. They have a unique DOI. And they can be a great way to kind of discuss either clinical trial data, conference data, but bringing in a bit more kind of personal experience or opinion. So it can be healthcare professionals, or we've had patient speakers, carers, nurses, etc. And because they're hosted on the SpringLink platform, but because they're podcasts, they're also hosted on Figshare as well as all the kind of podcast platforms, so Spotify, Apple Music, etc. So helping to increase dissemination, and they're generally fairly well read. More broadly, AI, I know this is going to be a topic of discussion today. So just briefly, Spring and Nature as a whole has been exploring AI options for a while. So at ADIS, we're kind of lucky to benefit from whatever they develop. So some recent developments have been Curie, which is an AI-powered writing tool, so particularly to help kind of scientific writers who maybe English isn't the first language. And then Spring and Nature have also recently acquired Slimmer AI. So they have a number of AI tools, but some include sort of helping to identify appropriate peer reviewers and helping to detect plagiarism and paper mills, that kind of thing. And then kind of back to ADIS, continuation of our other key services, like our pre-submission inquiry service, which is really popular. So this is where you can send us an abstract or an outline of a paper. We'll get back within 2 working days with a full list of all the ADIS journals that would consider that research. So by consider, we mean sent to peer review. We also provide editor feedback prior to peer review to give it the best chance of getting through review. We've actually just done some analysis this week into what the rejection rate has been for the papers that have come through the peer pre-submission inquiry service, and it drops it down to 10% rejection rate this year. Rapid publication and timely publication. And then getting back to conferences this year, which has been great. It's been so nice to get back to seeing authors and industry contacts face to face. So then looking ahead to next year, more of the same, everything we've just talked about, getting back out to conferences. We've got ISMAP EU in January, is the next one coming up. We've also just started or restarted our lunch and learn presentations. So this is where the senior editorial team can come either come out in person to your offices, as in Medcoms or pharma publication teams, or we can present virtually. I know a lot of hybrid working and work from home now. And we'll present on a key topic within publishing. So it might be digital features, data dissemination, patient involvement in publications, and we welcome suggestions of topics that you're interested to hear about, and we provide lunch as well. And then finally, more AI. So more developments, is obviously a rapidly evolving field, so looking at other ways to improve author services and all of our processes. So yeah, that's me.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Excellent. Lots to talk about in there. Hamish, you're next, I think, on our little list.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Peter. Yeah, so my name is Hamish McDougall, and I'm the Publishing Solutions Manager at Sage. So my job is essentially to act as a first point of contact for publications teams from Medcoms agencies and pharmaceutical companies. So any queries at all, including things like pre-submission inquiries or tracking down manuscripts or any special projects, rather than trying to find individual people within Sage, you can just use me as your point of contact for everything. So I'm particularly interested in improving accessibility and discoverability of medical communications, and that involves everything from digital features such as video abstracts, infographics, and podcasts. And I'm also very heavily involved in Sage's plain language summaries initiatives, and was delighted to be part of the team responsible for launching our plain language summaries of publications or standalone PLS article types earlier this year across several titles. So a bit of information about Sage. We have a very wide selection of journals, so over 250 in the clinical medicine space, from very well-known in-house titles such as the Multiple Sclerosis Journals to large society titles like Cephalalgia. We have a large portfolio of journals with various different publishing solutions, and we facilitate open access publishing across our entire journal portfolio, whether that be through hybrid open access models or gold open access models. We're also very well known for our therapeutic advances journals, which facilitate a very wide selection of publication options, including things like special issues, plain language summaries of publications, and our very open approach to publishing new article types and special projects. So we're very open to hearing new ideas and adapting and being flexible to whatever your needs are as well. And in generally, we pride ourselves as a publisher on being able to provide a very personal touch when working with our clients, and our flexibility and ability to adapt to new ideas. We're always on hand throughout the publication process to provide advice and assistance where necessary. So please do get in touch with me if you have any queries at all.
Excellent. Thanks, Hamish. Johnny, you're next, yeah?
Yeah, thanks very much, Peter. So I'm Jonathan Patience. I'm the head of publication development at Taylor & Francis. I've been working in medical publishing for about 12 years. And for the past several years, I've been co-leading on Taylor & Francis's plain language summaries initiative with my colleague, Kelly Soldevin. So that's something I'm really passionate about and looking forward to seeing how that develops over the coming years, too. So my team is responsible for liaising with industry publication teams to make sure that we're meeting their publication needs, and that includes discussing specific research outputs and publication plans. So please do get in touch with me if you would like to discuss any upcoming plans or publishing options for your work that includes specific manuscripts. So I'd love to hear from you on LinkedIn, connect with me, and I can either speak with you directly or connect you with someone in my team, and we can be your go-to person to discuss that and make sure you have the right research output for your work. So what's new with Taylor & Francis? Well, those paying attention to publishing news will hopefully have seen that we acquired Future Science Group on Monday this week. So that's obviously huge news for us. It strengthens our existing medical publications and services, especially within the pharma space. So we're really excited about working more closely with the Future Science Group team. For me, that's personally also really exciting because I started my career with them, and I really rate the innovation and their flexible approach to publishing. They also have some really high-level journals, and I'm really impressed by their plain language summaries and digital hubs, and all the work they've been doing in that space. The digital hubs, in particular, focus on sort of research communities, for example, in the oncology space. So I'm really excited about how we can work together with Taylor & Francis and Future Science Group. And I think over the next few months, we'll be identifying opportunities in that area. So obviously there's lots to come on that, but just to conscious of time, I'll try to cover some of my other points. So this year we have also been a supporter of Open Pharma, and we intend to be again next year. We also have several plain language summary initiatives underway. We launched plain language summaries of publications, also known as PLSPs, earlier this year, and we've got a few in the pipeline. So watch this space. Hopefully you'll see them published soon. We also launched patient perspectives article types on several journals. We've launched plain language specific peer review guidelines, which are now publicly available for anyone to read. So you can check that out on the Taylor & Francis website. And we've been working with other publishers, such as Bacaris, FSG, Sage, and Springer, those on this call. We're on a centralized database for plain language materials and just investigating options there. We also have a number of initiatives related to patient engagement, and we know that's a really important piece of the puzzle. So we have some things underway there, so watch this space for that. We also launched a new series of journals this year called the Elevate series, and they really focus on giving a gold standard author service with a really responsive author support. They have fast turnaround times with a fast desk decision and the first post peer review decision in 22 days. They offer good value. And a couple of journals that might be of interest to people listening here would be Annals of Medicine and potentially also All Life. We also launched a Journal of Translational Research as part of the Elevate series recently. We partnered with the European Alliance for Social Sciences and Humanities and the European Infrastructure for Translational Medicine to co-convene a research policy workshop on translational research to promote interdisciplinary collaboration. So if you're interested in that, you can find the report on our F1000 platform. A few other journal launches worth mentioning is we've launched Gastrointestinal Cancer Targets and Therapy, Dermato-Oncology, Journal of Health Equity, and Geriatric Pharmacology. So if you work within those fields, definitely check those out. And we're also now the new publisher of the Journal of Pharmaceutical Policy and Practice. Finally, obviously, artificial intelligence is a really big topic this year, and we've been investigating that in a variety of ways. Both looking at in our internal efficiencies and workflows, but also looking at what it can be used for in content generation. So, for example, plain language summary generation and journal launches in that area. So we're actively looking into those and keen to understand the needs for those types of services and products. So if you have interest and needs, then get in touch with me. I'll be happy to discuss those further. We also recently published some OA position AI position statements in our journal Current Medical Research and Opinion. We published an ISMAP position statement on AI in CMRO recently, and we also have a WAIM paper in the works. So watch out for that too. We also released a statement in February around responsible use of AI. I'd say the key takeaway from that is that AI should not be listed as an author, and where AI tools are used, it needs to be acknowledged transparently. So yeah, just to close off, just want to say with regards to next year, probably more of the same. You'll see us developing in everything I've mentioned so far, growing those in those areas. And we will continue to offer our research services, so things like accelerated publication, concierge on manuscript submission, the service that me and my team provide in terms of like one-to-one support on sort of pharma or medcoms publications which you want to publish with Taylor & Francis. We can speak to you about those personally, and we're also happy to deliver workshops. We've been running some workshops this year with various different companies, and also running our own corporate webinars series, which are the recordings are available online. And we hope to run more of those this year. So, yeah, very happy to continue those conversations. So please do connect with me on LinkedIn, and I'd love to discuss any of these further with you.
Excellent. Thanks, Johnny. And Joe, your turn.
Thanks, Peter. So I'm the co-founder and publishing director at Bicaris Publishing. So I've been in publishing for over 20 years, and most of that time was at my previous publisher, which was the Future Science Group. So Bicaris is so a small sort of startup publisher. We've only been going since September 2022. We publish just the one journal so far, which is the Journal of Comparative Effectiveness Research. And we also then have a companion digital platform called the Evidence Base. So our main focus, we're sort of really well, not restricting, we're really focused on sort of the health economics and outcomes research space. So our journal, JCER, covers that area, as well as sort of real world evidence, real world data, and obviously the comparative effectiveness sort of data. And, you know, we're really seeing a lot more interest in that whole real world evidence space sort of this year. So this year, JCER has transitioned to a purely open access journal. You know, there's always a worry when you're sort of transitioning a journal from a subscription model to an open access platform. And actually, we've seen that it's done really well. You know, we were worried that submissions might drop off, but actually, we've seen the opposite, and we think we've actually had more submissions. So I think that sort of like really underlines that, you know, everyone's sort of really interested in open access publishing. Within the journal as well, we're continuing to publish the standalone PLSPs that I established at Future Science Group. You know, there's a lot of interest in publishing these. You know, and I know as more and more journals as well become available to offer these options, I'm sure that there's going to be so many more of these types of articles available. Which is why, as sort of Johnny and Hamish mentioned, you know, we're sort of working as an across publisher sort of discovery project, looking at ways to sort of make a sort of dedicated platform to sort of housing these sort of plain language content. At Bicaris as well, we've also formed a partnership with Editage, which is my division of Cactus. So we'll be able to offer all our authors sort of, you know, research communication services. So that means sort of complementing their articles with infographics, video shorts, graphical abstracts, that sort of thing as well. You know, in addition to them providing this type of content, we'll be able to make those authors who just don't have access to sort of creative services the, you know, the ability to complement their articles with sort of digital features as well. So for me, the past year has been, I think, you know, it's absolutely flown by. As everyone else has mentioned, you know, there's sort of two main things that I think that we've had to sort of tackle. AI, as everyone has mentioned, has been the main thing. You know, do we include AI as a co-author, which we don't, and, you know, all the different sort of like policies that are, you know, keep evolving to try and make sure that our, you know, the journal, you know, keeps up to date with everything, and how, you know, how AI can be used as a tool in medical publishing. And, you know, I think it has its place, but I think it's also still growing, and it's still not sort of, you know, set in stone at the moment. And that's where sort of the ISMAP position papers will sort of help guide this as well. And another thing that we've seen as well is sort of peer review. I think I'm sure the others agree, we're sort of getting a bit of reviewer fatigue at the minute. You know, there's authors are back to conferences, they're writing papers, and I think just that their capacity to peer review is just sort of lessened slightly as well. So at Bicaris and the journal and JCR, we're exploring new ways to sort of incentivize reviewers to sort of make sure that the reviews that they return are timely. And this includes sort of, we're sort of, you know, trialing sort of honorarium or even charitable donations on their behalf. It seems to be doing so well so far, but whether it's sustainable, because obviously there's an admin and, you know, there's a lot of admin involved in that. And also it needs to be, you know, completely transparent as well. So this is just something to watch, but it's definitely something that we're trialing and have been experimenting with. And then next year, well, we've got a lot of developments in sort of aligning more our website, the evidence base, and the journal as well. We're sort of bringing them together in one platform. And we're also potentially looking at new journal launches, but that's something that we can't discuss quite yet. Okay, thanks.
Excellent, thanks. Okay, well, we covered a lot of ground there. So look, let's get some ground rules set up. We're going to talk for the next, I don't know, maybe 25 minutes or so. Members of the audience that are with us today, please ask questions, share observations and comments. We'll build that into the conversation. And we've had some quite specific questions coming in for individuals. What I'll just say as a general point is everyone here, they're the right people to talk to at their publishing companies. That's the whole point of this exercise, okay? So I think actually you all said that. So if anyone's interested in following up individually, please do. LinkedIn's an easy way of doing it. And on that basis, I'll probably not be covering some of the very specific questions that come in. But do talk to each other. Do follow up via LinkedIn and so on and make the contact. Again, I emphasize these panelists are the right people to be talking to. That's the beauty of this session each year, okay? We did cover a lot of ground there. Interesting how much you've all talked about plain language summaries already in plain language activity and so on. I want to come back to that. AI, obviously, you all highlighted again. We'll come back to that. I want to start with what Joe was talking about the peer review. And I know this is an area that everyone's sort of thinking about at the moment. But Joe, perhaps you can just sort of kick us off, although I guess you've already started, but kick us off a little bit. You've said that you're looking at how you're working with peer reviewers, incentivizing them and so on. Perhaps you can just take us a little bit further and then we'll get the others to comment on what they're doing at their companies.
I think it's not so much finding the peer reviewers that is an issue with peer review. I think, you know, there's a lot of, there's different ways that you can find peer review. Definitely not through ChatGPT, because that I did that earlier in this year. I thought that's it, ChatGPT is going to solve peer review. Just, you know, ask, find me 10 reviewers for a paper, give it a title, and it made up people that very legit and they just made them up. So that's definitely not that, you know, cross that one off. That's not going to solve peer review. But I think that, so we know at Becaris, we were exploring different ways just to make sure that peer review was just a bit more efficient. You know, we had a few papers that were in backlog. We were trying to sort of make sure that they were sort of trying to, you know, we want authors to publish quickly, you know, that, you know, we want them to achieve that goal. We don't want it sitting around for like 6 months. And we were finding that, you know, we'd ask, you know, sort of maybe 40, 50, 60 reviewers to review a paper. And it's not that they didn't want to, they just did not have the time. So we thought, why not maybe give them a bit of an incentive to try and do that on time. You know, if we found that when when we do plain language summaries of publications, we pay the peer reviewers because many of them are patients. We want to compensate them because we feel it's valid. When we thought, well, why not do that the same for peer reviewers? You know, they don't have to peer review. I mean, it is a part of the sort of ecosystem of publishing that peer reviewers have to peer review, but they don't necessarily have to. So I think that, you know, we've just been experimenting it, and we've had some really good feedback. People like having that small honorarium, and also people really appreciate a charitable donation on their behalf. You know, quite often they choose that as well. And I think that it's their way of sort of, you know, they feel a bit more valued rather than just saying, please, can you peer review? And then that's it. But I think it's not, you know, we have one journal. I can't imagine how it could be done for 3,000 journals. You know, it's
just out of interest and just to lay the groundwork, as it were, and bring the others in a second. But as you say, you've got a small community you're dealing with, essentially. But just in terms of your ground rules, you offer a payment and then they give you your peer review and they get the payment. Is that the way it works?
That's
and
right.
I'm not being funny about it, but if they don't deliver or they don't deliver what you want, then, I mean, there's a bit of an area in there, presumably.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, that's a sort of greyish, and we've not had that at the minute. Right. You know, once they, you know, maybe they've had a couple of days leeway here and there where they've not provided a timely peer review, or you know, but because we have such a small community, you know, the HEOR people, experts that we work with, are very, you know, they like to peer review each other's work. So I think it's worked quite well, and they've been quite, you know, agreeable to the terms that we've offered them. But you know, it's not to say that we're going to get a few odd people who don't agree, and then we'll have to we'll have to deal with that.
Okay, but it's worked for you, and this is a long-standing problem, isn't it? I mean, we've often talked about the problems of peer review and finding people with the time and so on to do it. But I think this is the first time I've heard you talking about paying them or exploring those sorts of options. I may be wrong, but that's the first time I remember us talking specifically about that. I don't know who Johnny. Have you got some views on this? I mean, you've got a much, much, much bigger crowd of people out there to deal with.
Yeah, it's a good point, and I think Jared is a good point that it's. I think Tech in France is about 2,500 journals, so it's quite difficult to do something like that at scale. But we have been looking at, we do sort of, we have been experiencing the same issues with not necessarily finding peer reviewers, but reviewers just having the time to agree and being able to dedicate that. I think they're under increased pressure to publish and to peer review, and we are seeing increased levels of research output from all over the world. So they receive more and more invitations to peer review for different journals. So there's, how do they choose which ones they accept and which ones they decline? And really it has to be, I think often it tends to be the case that the ones that are most aligned with their interests, they're interested in, and they like to have the opportunity to sort of preview some of that work before it comes out potentially. So I think that it is a real challenge. Some of the things that we've been doing in the past is we've experimented with a few different kinds of incentives, things like giving free access to journals for reviewers for agreeing to review. When we have our accelerated publication service, in order to turn around reviews quickly, there is an honorarium that's offered for that. We also have been working quite hard in reviewer training. So we have a team who works in training reviewers, and they do webinars with universities and institutions all over the world to help train reviewers in how to review well. And so basically trying to kind of help earlier career researchers kind of develop those skills and help to kind of build up the reviewer pool for people who really would like those opportunities to review and to be able to review it well. So we have a training program, and we have kind of a certified trained reviewers that we invite to review certain papers too. But yeah, I think there's always more that can be done, and I think we are also investigating some other initiatives as pilots to see how else we can better incentivize reviewers and recognize them for the work.
Okay. Just sticking with this specific topic for a moment, Claire, what are you doing at ADIS in terms of incentivizing your peer reviewers?
Yeah, so we don't currently pay any of our reviewers at ADIS. Other areas of Springer Nature do. We've talked about it. We don't for a number of reasons, some of which you touched upon, Joe, like the admin side of it, but also determining what a quality review is. You often get a review that just says yes, accept. Is that worthy of payment? Are we going to get into the debate with the reviewers about that? So we have other incentives. So we have things like if they're on the editorial board, they're entitled to two free publications per year, because there's obviously a fee for the rapid service that we provide. And then on the advisory board, which is more of the like day-to-day reviewers, if they carry out five what we call quality reviews, again, it's kind of a bit subjective maybe, but five quality reviews within a year, they're entitled to a free publication, which obviously has to go through peer review. There's no guarantee of publication. So yeah, they're the main things we do at the moment. I mean, we are developing tools within Springer Nature to help with reviewer identification, but like you said, we've all said, it's not so much the finding of the reviewers, it's the time it takes and the increasing number of publications and content out there.
Okay, and Hamish, I just want to finish this specific question with yourself as well. Just get the situation at Sage. What do you do in terms of incentivizing?
Absolutely, and yeah, no, I think I can sort of mirror a lot of the comments that have been made already, but I think a lot of the solutions that we've explored have been quite similar. One thing I don't think we've mentioned is Publons, but it's a platform that essentially exists to credit people who do regularly review and sort of actually sort of put a mark on their profile and say, okay, this is somebody that does regularly contribute to peer review and then is an active part of the academic community, so that they are a platform that we've partnered with. But I think, yeah, ultimately the key word is incentivizing. So we have looked at things like APC waivers on our open access journals and things like that for regular reviewers in the past as well. We have explored the idea of paid peer review, and for especially in our plain language summary space, that is something where we do have to pay our patient reviewers, because we do feel like they do sort of warrant compensation for their time. And we have had some discussions and some trials around sort of paying peer reviewers, but obviously, being a sort of a 1,000 journal company and sort of having 200 plus medical journals, it does sort of get into challenging territory, sort of looking at paying, hundreds of thousands of reviewers a year, just particularly on the admin side as well.
Just and okay, so that's great. Thank you very much. And it's just interesting to hear the sort of issues that you're facing. But Hamish, let's just pick up on a point you made. But and everyone's making the same sorts of points. But I'm going to follow what you said with Hamish in terms of paying your patient reviewers, particularly around PLS. So let's just open up that discussion a little bit in terms of the role of patient reviewers. I mean, again, I mean, when people talk about peer review, they tend not to think about patients. So let's just talk a little bit about patient reviewers in this process. Again, questions like how are you finding them? Can you find them? Do you pay them? And so on. You're all implying that with those as a group, you would probably pay more willingly than others. But how do you find them in the first place? And how does that process work? How do you find patients as reviewers?
I
How
mean,
much
I'm
training do they need? How enthusiastic are they? Hamish, just take that for a minute and see where it goes.
sure, and I'm very happy to answer this question. And unfortunately, like a lot of the work has been done already around this. A lot of guidelines have been set up, and I think patient advocacy groups have been a fantastic place to kind of go out and sort of speak to people. And there are sort of a lot of patient advocates who are very heavily involved in medical research. Some who will all be sort of very familiar with and likely all working with. And they also are able to sort of recommend additional patients within their communities who are sort of very familiar with the literature. I think one of the keys for us when we are identifying reviewers is having sort of a very wide pool because ultimately we're asking our patient reviewers to review the plain language elements. And one of the tricky things is that patients are becoming increasingly very educated. So when we are looking at patient reviewers, we are looking at patient reviewers outside of their specific condition. I mean, patients in rare diseases are far more familiar than sort of most doctors about what's going on in their disease. So it is sort of having sort of a very wide pool and sort of making sure that they are able to sort of review the plain language elements specifically.
Joe, do you want to come in on this one? What's your experience of working with the patient reviewers on the PLS side, for instance?
I think you can get two types of patient reviewers for the for PLS, well, especially for the standalone PLSPs. You can get the sort of the patient reviewers who perhaps have authored papers, not necessarily PLSPs, but have some sort of author types of articles, and you can ask them to review a paper, a PLSP, because they are familiar with the topic. They'll know sort of, they can review it to make sure that what is being said is relevant for their community. But you've also then there's a now a raft of sort of plain language of patients who are now also experts in writing in plain language. So you could get them to review the PLSPs for just basically for the plain language principles. Does it follow all those different principles, active voice, that sort of thing? And is it clear? Is it readable? Because when I was at FSG, and I know FSG's published more than 100 of these now, and often the same reviewers will be used, again and again. So they now have a lot of experience in reviewing these types of article, what to look for. They can even suggest ideas for different ways to represent some of the data, visually, that sort of thing. So I think there's different ways that you can work with sort of patient reviewers as well. And more of them are now becoming authors themselves, so they're familiar with the publishing process. I think that's also useful, is to know, what the peer review means in the context of an article, that sort of thing, and what they're looking for. So I think it's definitely evolving.
On that point, let's go that direction. Patient authors. I mean, I think you just said, and I would have said, and I think most people nod their heads, but is there any sort of numbers behind it? There are more patient authors nowadays than there used to be. But have you got any, is there any sense of, can anyone give me a bit of a context on that?
I think you can
Or not?
find patient authors. I think so. There's a tagging system that we've now started to use, which is fairly standard across publishers, which is to for a patient author to list their institution as a patient author, and then with us associated with perhaps the city where they live, or they can also
Oh, I
identify
see.
other
Right.
institutions that they work at. So if you wanted to identify if that's being used consistently, and I believe most of us in this call as publishers, we are seeing that is used, you should be able to find it on PubMed. So you should be able to search by institution and search for patient author, and hopefully be able to find all the manuscripts which have included a patient author.
Yeah, and we're
Okay,
seeing it
that's interesting. I
increasing.
didn't know that. Gone glass.
increasing in numbers, definitely, and across different article types as well. So, I mean, we launched sort of patient physician perspective articles a few years ago. So, and at that time, that was pretty much our only article type that had patient authors. Whereas now we're seeing patient authors on original research articles, podcast articles, all article types, really. So, yeah, I mean, exact numbers, I could go and have a look, but definitely on the up.
I think the main thing as well is that they have to meet that sort of ICMJ criteria. So I think, and I think now as well, as because well, you know, pharma companies are now involving patients, you know, in the steering committees for clinical trials. So I think, you know, that's still in an early stage, but I think, you know, in a few years, it could be that patient authors will be the main author, you know, some of the authors on actually, you know, your big phase three clinical trials, you know, because there's this patient involvement in research is just becoming more, you know, is evolving. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see, you know, maybe in a few years' time, NEJM will have a, you know, a patient author on a phase three clinical study. That, you know, that would be really nice to see, I think.
I
Can I
mean,
just
as an
say?
observer, it seems to me that everyone's going in the same direction on this one. You know, everyone approves of the idea of patient involvement, and we're heading in that direction. I mean, I'm being a bit simplistic, but we'd all agree on that. Yeah, and there's no resistance in the system. It's just a slow process getting there. Is that right?
Absolutely. And just further to Jay's point as well, I can't recommend enough the resource patientauthorship.com that's been developed by Envision. So for anyone looking to involve patient authors, it really is a fantastic guide. And I think it's always worth taking a look at that.
Okay. Let's just spend a couple of minutes on PLS because we could spend the entire next hour on PLS. But let's just we're going to have to be a bit quick because I can see we're going to start this conversation's going to go on longer than we've got time for. And I still want to talk about AI. Okay, guys, we're going to have to get that in the end. So, but PLS, let's just talk a little bit about PLS. Claire, I'm going to ask you to kick it off actually because your terminology is a little bit different, isn't it? Let's
Yes.
start there and go see where we go from there.
Yeah, so our standalone summaries are called summary of research articles. We do publish like the PLS abstracts, which, you know, the plain language summary abstract alongside a standard abstract within a paper. But our standalone summaries of previously published papers are called summary of research articles. And they're a little different to, I think, the other publishers here, in that we are primarily targeting healthcare professionals. So we're not primarily targeting patients. Obviously, as I said, that open access, so well-informed patients can access the content in the same way that they can with any open access content. But yeah, they're primarily targeted at like non-specialist, time poor healthcare professionals. And I mean, we've had examples. At the moment, we're closely vetting them all that come in to assess the language. We've had some that are oversimplified, so we've gone back and worked with the authors, you know, if it's just a sentence here and there, some that go the other way and have sentences that are too jargon filled. But we'll try and work with the authors if the basis is there to make sure that the level of language is hard, because that's obviously the really subjective part of what is plain language. So we work with them initially, and then they'll be reviewed by, we have some patient reviewers, but alongside standard reviewers checking the science as well.
I always have the same problem. I might as well bring it up, but people will be bored of me saying this. That when we're talking about anything to do with PLS, we get a bit confused, or people get a bit confused because they're, are we all talking about the same thing? And it's interesting that you're carefully phrasing your discussion about the papers as opposed to summaries as being for healthcare professionals. Joe, this is your area of expertise. So talk a little bit to this problem I have, which is that if people talk about plain language summaries of publications, they might be talking about something specific for a patient. They might be talking about something for a healthcare professional, a more generalist. They might be talking about this magic sort of something that's just more accessible to everybody. And I never know quite how that works in practice because you've got to pitch it sort of in a certain direction. I'm being a bit whatever about this, but just talk a little bit to that one because I do think it confuses a lot of people.
It does, but I think you need to think about them, not necessarily who they're for, but how they're written. So they are, it's just a plain language summary. So it's not necessarily for patients, for HCP. It's just a summary of an article written in plain language, in plainer language, so that, you know, it's not, as Claire was saying, you know, it's not full of jargon. It's, you know, it's used in short sentences, active voice, which is just easier to read. You know, most scientific articles are written in passive voice, which is really difficult to, often difficult to read. You know, the sentences go on for like, you know, 100 words almost. So I think it's just, you know, short sentences, it's just, they're just really easier to read. So, and that could then mean that that research can then be understood by patients, but also by, you know, by researchers themselves. You know, it could be that you've got health economists wanting to know about multiple sclerosis because they're doing research in that particular field. So they could read the different plain, you know, plain language summaries of that area just to get themselves familiar with that research. So I think you need to think about it more about how the article, what it is, rather than who it's for. I think that makes sense.
It's the format of them as well. I agree. You know, we can add a lot more graphics or, you know, some of the kind of more accessible, nicer SRAs that we've published so far being purely graphic based, you know, with a bit of text in, just to make the content really easily and quickly understood, whereas you can't necessarily do that with a standard article.
Okay, so my question, again, I've said this before in situations like this, but to you as a group of publishers, why don't you just insist that the first article is published in a more accessible, plainer language version? Why do we go through this process of publishing something that you more or less are admitting isn't very accessible and then go through a process of redoing it? I just, Hamish, go on, run with it. I know I'm being slightly, again, evocative, but what's your answer to that? Because I think it's a reasonable question from most people's points of view.
It's a very reasonable question, but I think, you know, there are some things that do require certain levels of technical language, but I do think there is an element of, you know, we could do away with a lot of sort of, you know, some of the non-plain language. And I think it's, you know, it's really sort of, we've developed this kind of habit of gatekeeping science, and I don't think a lot of it is necessary. I mean, there are certain things, you know, for example, if you're working in oncology and you're talking about certain mutations, and they do require sort of specific descriptive language. But, you know, when we get into plain language summaries, we are still able to break those down. So I think, you know, it's a very interesting question, not one that I have a definitive answer for.
It's where AI could come in, though. You could be, you know, you should be able to toggle, can you read it in the original language or read it in plain language? You know, that could be the ultimate goal.
Johnny, just pick up on this a bit, because I think that's exactly the lead into AI that I was following, sort of thing. Why? And it seems like there's a huge opportunity for AI to represent information. So, and there's a lot of discussion around this in our business, has been all year. Do you just put an AI tool on the front or something, or just use AI to reproduce these articles in different languages and different whatever? Just run with it, Louis. Let's open this up for a few minutes to the whole topic of AI, which we're not going to cover in 5 minutes.
I definitely think that there is a lot of potential for AI in plain language summary generation. I reviewed plain language summaries in a number of different projects of research and reviewed the different tools involved. And I think it's very interesting to see the differences in output by tool. Some are much better than others. I would say that my kind of conclusion from having done some of that work is probably that AI can actually is quite good at summarizing research in plain language, but it can also miss key points and it can also misrepresent the facts. So it may misread something and then interpret that in a completely different way from what it was intended, and then basically state that as a fact. So there are definite dangers and risks. So I would say certainly we're not at the stage where we'd be able to do it without any sort of human intervention or verification at some stage. But I definitely think as kind of creation of the first draft of a plain language summary, which is then fact checks and made sure that the representation of that work is accurate and not misleading. But there is also another point, which is that around copyrights and, well, it's around not just copyright, but also confidentiality, which is that if you're putting your work into large language models, essentially you're uploading it to, you know, almost like a big database. And if you're putting in that work that might not be published yet, then you're potentially breaching your company's confidentiality agreements that you may have for the work that you're working with. So it's quite risky, I think, to be putting that into an LLM. So that's one side of it. That's prior to publication. And post publication, there's also issues around copyright infringement, which a number of publishers are looking into. And I think that isn't quite resolved yet. I think it's quite a complicated, like, legal question of whether copyright is being infringed and what that looks like. And I'll leave that to the legal team to investigate. But I think it is, yeah, it's quite complicated. So it's not quite as simple as we just put it in this tool. I think you need to think about, like, who else is accessing that tool, where that data is stored, how publicly available everything is.
It's interesting, just the point you said early on, something about different tools are producing different results. I mean, I would strongly argue that a tool can produce very different results depending on the skill of the person that's using it. And I think, again, we've just got to be careful in this sort of a very brief discussion that there's a lot of nuance to this, a lot of different approaches, a lot of things to think about. But some people are becoming very skilled at using any of the tools, and there are many tools out there to do different things. Yeah, so it's not a question of tool one is good at this, tool two is bad at this. It's a question of how we use the tools. I think there's a different sort of way of thinking in there. One of the things, I mean, I can't remember who said it, sorry, but I don't know who said it. So someone just put their hand up, was talking about, I think it might have been Claire actually, but talking about AI tools, and providing AI tools to writers maybe where English isn't the native language and so on. And that's perhaps a slightly different and an interesting angle on use of AI. Do you want to say a few words? It was Claire, wasn't it, that was talking about that?
Yeah, it was. It's a Springer Nature tool. I haven't used it personally, so I can tell you what I know, but I can certainly find out more. But it's launched, it's out there kind of in the public domain. It's called Curie. So it's just to aid with the writing. So I guess that's slightly different in terms of,
Can you spell that, Clary?
oh,
What, how are you
sorry,
spelling
yeah,
Curie?
Curie, as in Marie Curie.
Excellent. Okay, thanks. Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's slightly different in terms of what we're talking about, because we, like Jonathan said, we have to be conscious of confidentiality. So we as publishers, if we're, if we're given a an article that hasn't yet been published, we can't really be putting that into ChatGPT, for example, because it's confidential. Whereas this would be the authors themselves. They have the rights to their work and the tool. I can't tell you exactly how the tool works, but it
That's
would
fine.
assist
That's
with the
fine.
writing and that side of
But it's
things.
an interesting different angle on this. And again, if we have to just at least touch on the fact there's lots of different angles to this sort of thing. One of the so that effectively and simplistically, you're encouraging authors or a certain group of authors to use AI tools. Yeah, we're very clear. Someone made the point very clearly early on. It is not okay to have an AI tool, ChatGPT, as an author. That's been sort of like clearly discussed. But using AI, this contention around whether you encourage people or ban people, whatever, you're actually pursuing a line where, in some cases at least, it's useful to do that.
Yeah, and
Has anybody else got a comment on whether, sorry, I'm going to keep moving this around because we're going to run out of time. How much guidance do you offer? Just a very simple practical question. Are you building into guidance to authors any comment about whether you do or don't use AI tools? You see what I'm saying? Has anyone got a simple answer to that? Hamish, you look like you're going to say something.
yeah, I think we've provided some guidance around it, and obviously things like, not having it as an author. But I think one of the things, especially when we're dealing with generative AI, is to caution people that as while it is a fantastic tool and great at things like pastiche for generating plain language summaries, there are a lot of issues, and one of them in particular is sort of objectivity and bias. Obviously, LLMs are trained on papers that do contain bias, and LLMs aren't able to sort of determine those. So sometimes, you may be getting a sort of a very you, some of those biases may crawl into papers as well, and we have to be sort of very cautious of those. And obviously, we have discussed things like accuracy and hallucinations as well. So while they are very, very useful tools, our guidelines have to stress, and they have to say, you need to be conscious of these. There needs to be a heavy level of human verification, just so that we are making sure that these things don't actually sort of taint the quality of the papers.
I think
Okay, and
another
John,
thing,
from your, oh, sorry, Joe, go on. Go on,
just
John.
another thing, just from a writing point of view. I mean, I think they can be really used to enhance enhance writing. You know, everybody kind of gets, you know, writer's block or doesn't know where to start. So you could use it as a starting point for, like, maybe, you know, some background information, or, you know, suggest a title, you know, even just suggesting a title for a paper. You could come up, because that, you know, everybody knows that the title is, you know, you need to have a really good title for an article. So you could even, you know, you could write a really boring title in ChatGPT and ask, I mean, there's no proprietary information there, ask it to come up with a more creative title. I mean, even so, just to really sort of like support people when they're writing, I think that is where the real advantage of these tools lies. Not necessarily for creating new content or anything like that, but just really using it as, you know, almost like, you know, you could always have it akin to spell check, Grammarly or something like that, just to be able to really sort of help make things clearer, you know, and also then can help with, you know, writing in active voice, short sentences, that sort of thing, just to really help make content clearer. That's where I see the real advantage of these tools is. And to be honest, I write quite some content for our website, and I always use ChatGPT to help me sort of, like, you know, just start off, you know, even like a little short paragraph, or, you know, I rewrite it always, but just as a little starting point, I think it's just so helpful.
I guess what I'm trying to get at, and Johnny, have you got a comment? And if you're, it's interesting to me that people are wrestling over this idea of have to put specific guidance into, or specific words into the guidance. If we're all saying it's just a tool, we don't talk about all the other tools people can or can't use. And yet we feel driven to be saying something about the AI tools. I just find that interesting. I don't know, I suspect it'll end up getting flushed out of the system. But, you know, I'm just intrigued about how much you're putting in specific guidance at the moment about something that we're all sort of saying, well, it's just a tool anyway. But Johnny, what's the situation at your end?
Yeah, I mean, so Taylor & Francis released a statement in February, so shortly after ChatGPT became, you know, became very popular, basically stating the sort of some considerations that authors need to take if they are going to be using those tools. We've already covered the fact that they shouldn't be used as an author, considered as an author, and ultimately the researcher bears the responsibility for the work. And I think we also say that if you are going to use AI, then there needs to be, it needs to be transparent, it needs to be fully acknowledged exactly what you've done and how you've used it and what tool you've used. I can't really comment on how that might evolve, because I think at the moment there are some quite complex factors in play. I call them on the copyright infringement, for example. So, you know, publishers at the moment are fairly kind of broad. They're not sort of necessarily saying you should do this or you shouldn't do this. They acknowledge that they can be useful and acknowledge that if you are going to be doing it, these are the considerations that you need to take into account. I don't know whether, as those kind of those investigations continue, whether the things might change one way or another, whether they actually start saying, actually, maybe they have these agreements with LLMs and now we're saying it's okay, or maybe actually know that this isn't really something that people should be using because there's all these other complex legal cases at play. So I think, I'm afraid I can't really comment on where it might go in the future. I think at the moment it's...
Okay. In fairness, we've run out of time, so we should draw. There's so much more I'd like to be talking about, guys. Okay, but I'm going to draw the line for the recording. Okay, just what I'm picking up on a question. I think it was Mario who came in early on, but just I think we just let's make this point. You're the right people to talk to. Mario's asking, do publishers encourage authors to submit pre-submission inquiries? You've always said yes.
Yeah.
And I'm just emphasizing the fact that you guys are entirely appropriate people to talk to. Yeah. And are pre-submission inquiries worth the trouble? I guess you'll just say yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's the whole point of, in some cases, to some extent, your roles is to try and smooth that process. So hopefully, Mario, that gives you a clear answer to that question. I'd love to keep this going. I always feel frustrated with this discussion because there's so much we can discuss. But it's a great opportunity to hear from you the sorts of things that are happening at the individual companies. It's interesting to hear some of the topics that are affecting the publishing business and so on. And I would very much encourage anyone listening to this to contact you via LinkedIn and follow up the discussions and continue the discussions and so on and so forth. So just for the moment, members of the audience, don't rush away because we have only got a couple of minutes. We will carry on for a couple of minutes. But members of the audience, thanks very much. Panelists, thank you very much. Quick wave and wish everybody a good luck. Take care.